everybody. The year is 1984. MTV is now a music kingmaker, and in the Motor City, they are cranking out double playlays and doubles as Alan Trammell, Lou Whitaker, Kurt Gibson, and Chet Lemon are Michigan's newest hit makers. Dan Petrie, Jack Morris, and Willie Hernandez are mowing down hitters while Prince turns Purple Rain into pure platinum. Hitch a ride with us on the train to Motown as we dive into a field guide to 1984 on Rock and Roll Shinsu Chu. It's good to be back, everybody. We've been a little bit MIA in 2024, but it feels so good to be back. My name is Gabe Estill. I'm here with my co-hosts, Dennis Levi Leach and Jonathan Getz. How's it going, fellas?
Good.
Good. Good to see you. Well, we're going to be diving into a fun year of music and baseball today. We're going to start off with baseball and then segue over to music, which is a really unbelievable year of music. But speaking of unbelievable years, probably the guy that had one of the most unbelievable seasons is Willie Hernandez for the Detroit Tigers. When we started researching this episode, guys, that was not a name that first came to mind, even though he won the American League MVP and Cy Young, and he's a relief pitcher. Is this guy like in your baseball memory anywhere? Because he was not in mine.
No. Yeah. I remember discovering him a couple years ago and doing some research, going down a rabbit hole. I'm like, what? Who's what?
It's like a trivia question. You know what I mean? That's what he is. Yeah. And I don't mean to dismiss the guy's gear. Obviously, as we're going to talk about, he put up a phenomenal year in 1984, and it led to a World Series victory. But yeah, just not a guy that, I don't know, man. He had a couple decent seasons other than this, but I think he was an All-Star the next 2 years as well in 85 and 86. But, you know, he's one of those like, you know, like almost like baseball's equivalent of a one-hit wonder, you know? And again, I mean that in the most respectful way to the guy, but it really is a little bit of an anomaly, you know?
Yeah. So the as a relief pitcher, I think he started his career with the Cubs.
Right. Late 70s.
Yeah. Ironically. And he was with the Cubs until 83. And then in 84. Yeah. He appeared in 80 games, 140 innings for a relief pitcher and a 204 ERA plus. So he was like twice as good as basically anybody else or any other average starting pitching. 0.941 whip.
How many saves did he had? He had just 32 saves, but he was doing a lot of heavy lifting there.
A lot of wins for a reliever too. 9 wins, I think.
Yeah. Getting in there, you know, a lot of innings. And so, he was unbelievable, but then inevitably got touched up a little bit in the postseason. And that's always kind of a thing that gives me a lot of anxiety, regardless of who I'm rooting for, is when a relief pitcher who is untouchable in the regular season comes in the postseason, and I'm like, right. Oh no, he's gonna get touched up. Like I feel like I just know it, and for some reason, it always bothers me when an untouchable relief pitcher gets touched up in the postseason. I mean,
yeah,
Mariano Rivera gave up a World Series. Mariano Rivera gave up a World Series losing hit the postseason, right? So it happens.
Yeah, you're just used to those guys delivering all the time, you know, during the regular season.
So
it's bound to make a fan anxious when one of those guys goes out to the postseason, even though you should have a lot of confidence. But I hear you there.
And R.I.P. Willie, we just lost him a year ago. Last November.
Yeah, the New York Times wrote a nice obit on him that I read. Puerto Rican guy. Seemed pretty humble dude, and really was just kind of surprised by it all as everybody else was that year.
Right. Yeah. Well, and baseball, that it was a different time for sure.
Yep.
Where like relief pitchers were like, like had like accolades thrust upon them like that as much. And like every year it was the Rolaids Relief Award and all that, which funny enough, he didn't win that year. He lost it to Dan Quisenberry.
Go figure.
Dan Quisenberry.
So Quiz won it 2 years in a row, right? Because I think Quiz won it in 85 too.
He won it in like Dan Quisenberry won the Rolaids Relief Award in 1980, 82, 83, 84, 85.
When you go into the Royals out at Kauffman Stadium, when you go into the Royals Hall of Fame museum in the outfield, they have the Rolaids fireman's helmet.
Yeah, because that display. Was the trophy. Yeah.
It's an awesome trophy. It's really
yeah.
Great.
Yeah, it was a classic award back in the day. It's funny that Willie had done a lot to earn accolades, but didn't beat out the Quiz.
Yeah, and I feel like it's kind of diminished now too. You know, the I don't like that think award at least.
Let me look. They last gave it in 2012.
Oh man, bring back the helmet, yo!
Bring right. back the Rolaids yeah. Relief Award.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. And guys, man, that streak of Quisenberry there. Like, if Quisenberry's not in the Hall of Fame, which he isn't, unfortunately, put him at. Can't we make like a situational Hall of Fame? You know what I mean? Like for like clutch people.
Yeah,
they do
yeah.
that with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame now. Where
yeah.
like,
yeah,
you
right.
know, there'll be people who are inducted into the Rock Hall of Fame, but then like there are people inducted as like I forget what the terms they use, but yeah.
Right.
They should definitely consider that with like the NFL, MLB, NBA.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Wholeheartedly.
Well, yeah, you knew the Tigers were going to be good because they started that season that year against your White Sox, Gabe, with a no-no.
Yeah, right.
And then when they started
35-5.
Nuts.
Yeah, that's
35-5. That's nuts.
Yeah. And their run differential that year was like a plus 192, and like the next closest team was like plus 102 or something like that. Like 110. It wasn't even close.
No. They won the division by like 15 games.
Wire to wire. They were like the fourth ever team to go wire to wire, first place to the World Series championship.
Right. You know, seven teams back then. I think we could all make a case that just a more competitive divisional picture. You know,
mm-hmm.
So yeah, this is a pretty miraculous team, and really, you know, there was that one year, maybe like 06, that the Tigers went to the World Series. This is really for at least a Tigers fan. Our age to maybe like 10 years older, you know, this is the crowning achievement, obviously, you know, 1984.
Yeah. Yeah. They were stellar. Kirk Gibson. Who I've grown a lot of admiration for is mm-hmm. much more than his 1988 World Series home run off of Dennis Eckersley. Did you know that yep. Gibson was a, he was he's a collegiate Hall of Fame football player as a tight end for Michigan State, and he was drafted by the St. Louis Cardinals football team the same year he was drafted by I think the Tigers, he was goaded into joining the baseball team like his senior year of college, and then he just it was like his first year playing baseball, and then he was drafted the next year in the MLB draft.
Totally like a Michigan guy through and through.
Mm-hmm.
And totally like a Michigan guy through and through, you know?
Yeah.
Which I like to see. Let's take a look at the lineup here, right? They got Lance Parrish. This is not in the order they were hitting, but this is their starting nine. Lance Parrish, right? One of mm-hmm. the best catchers of the 80s, certainly. You know, he put up 33 home runs of 98 RBIs that year. So fantastic power numbers for a catcher. Dave Bergman, right? Who I don't know if he was looks like he did not start the whole season. He was at first base. Lou Whitaker, you know, perennial all-star. Alan Trammell, Hall of Famer, perennial all-star. Hojo, a very young Hojo, who I have to admit, I always think of Hojo in a Mets uniform,
same.
So it was a little weird to see this. Larry Herndon, right? Chet Lemon, Kirk Gibson, and they brought in the veteran from Boston, Darrell Evans, that year, who you know, put up pretty good numbers as well. Well, a low batting average, but still, you know, he did what he needed to do at DH. And then they had Rupert Jones off the bench putting up pretty good numbers too. So, like, I don't know, of that starting nine, like, you've got like 7 of 9 of those guys as consistently on an all-star team. You know,
fun fact: Kirk Gibson never made an all-star team, or never appeared in an all-star game. He refused 2 invites.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He was never elected to an all-star game.
He just didn't believe in it, or what?
No. Like, well, I don't think he was ever voted in as a starter. And then a couple times, a coach, you know how coaches, the manager will add guys. He was selected to be added, and he just politely declined.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go figure. Yeah.
So they've got 4 guys in the top 20 for MVPs that year, for American League MVP.
Wow.
They give it to Hernandez, probably kind of unexpectedly.
Yeah.
Gibson finishes 6th, Trammell finishes 9th, and then Parrish finishes 16th.
Wow.
And 4 all-stars in the lineup. Well, I guess that doesn't include pitchers, so probably some pitchers too, all-stars as well. So, yeah, just a kick-ass team, man.
It is. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, well, there's no way, you know, to flip it to the other division. There's no way I think any National League team could have beat them that year.
No. No.
And in 1984, the National League was like bizarro world. The hot teams were the Padres, the Mets, and the Cubs.
Right.
Could you imagine saying that today? Like, right. The Padres, the Mets, and the Cubs are hot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a weird. Yeah. So that was.
But yeah. The four playoff teams.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the 4 playoff teams. Granted, 3 of these teams made the playoffs this year in 2024, but they're not like perennial playoff teams by any means.
Yeah. Right.
The Cubs, the Padres, the Tigers, and the Royals were the 4, you know, the final 4 that year.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and the AL West, which was who the Royals were representing, was pretty middling.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the White Sox, you know, obviously my White Sox, extremely strong year. The year before, they were meteor. They were below average the next year. Baltimore, who won the World Series. Ripken had a stellar year again, but Baltimore, who won the World Series, they dropped off quite a bit.
Yeah,
you know, that next season. So yeah, it was Detroit's to lose basically.
But the Cubs were stout that year, right, Levi? Cubs?
No, yeah. I mean, we've talked about the '84 Cubs a lot in the past, so I wasn't going to dive deep into them. But yeah, the Cubs were really good that year, man. They made the move to bring in Rick Sutcliffe, which seemed to like steer the ship
mid-season, like what, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, right there before the All-Star break, I believe it was a date infamous in Cubs lore, 6/23/84.
Yes.
And so that was the day that Ryan Sandberg was introduced into the nation, because it was the NBC game of the week, I think, with Bob Costas. Mm. And it was a crazy, awesome game with the Cubs against the Cardinals at Wrigley. And it was like the Willie McGee show. He, I think, was like 5 for 5, might have hit for the cycle.
Yeah.
And so, like, in the 9th inning, they're giving him, like, the player of the game award and stuff. Meanwhile, Ryan Sandberg gets up to bat against Bruce Sutter, hits a home run, ties the game. They go into extra innings. Then Sandberg hits another home run off Bruce Sutter to also tie the game. Then the Cubs came back and scored another run and won the game. So, literally, Ryan Sandberg kind of went from an unknown to, like, superstardom. It's as big of a star as you can be in 1984 without social media or the internet.
Yeah,
right.
But it
won the MVP.
Huge, yeah, you know? It was huge, huge news. Because I mean,
Sutter was a badass.
Well, yeah, he was the Rolaids relief perennial award winner almost in the other leagues. So yeah, it just
a hell of a showing, no doubt.
Yeah, so. That was, you know, the Cubs were great that year. It was a big disappointment.
Yeah.
But a fun fact of the All-Star game that year, I don't know if you guys saw this in your you know, investigations into 1984. But in the All-Star game, Fernando Valenzuela, RIP, he and Doc Gooden pitched back-to-back innings in the All-Star game, and they struck out the side.
Wow.
They each struck out the side in back-to-back innings in the 1984 All-Star game.
Damn.
Which I don't know when the last time that's been done, but I would say it might be a while, but who knows?
So, that's a good segue into Doc Gooden. You know, should he have won the Cy Young over Rick Sutcliffe? So, Levi Cubs apologist, and don't get me wrong, Rick Sutcliffe had a hell of a year.
They were both really, really good.
Sutcliffe pitched in the NL for essentially July, August, and September that year. He pitched in the AL to begin the season.
He pitched against tougher batting, I would say, for sure.
But he wasn't very good in his stint with Cleveland.
He wasn't. It was like as soon as he got to the Cubs, he turned it on.
He went 16-1. He went 16-1 with the Cubs, 150 innings pitched, and 155 strikeouts. Gooden went 17-9, a better ERA by a few points, 276 strikeouts and 218 innings pitched.
He was 19 years old.
Yeah,
Gooden right.
was
19. Yeah, yeah.
And so the voters are like, look, Gooden, we'll give you the rookie of the year, but we're going to give the vet the
part
the
of
side.
Me thinks that's probably their reasoning. Yeah, yeah, I would agree with that.
And they were mesmerized by the 16-1 record.
Wasn't this still an era when it was still like, in my mind, it's like old sports writers behind desks with like cigars and hats and working for the Sporting News.
Yeah.
Right, on a manual typewriter. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. So, like, yeah, I can see them being like, I'm not giving it to that rookie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong. Sutcliffe had a hell of a stint with the Cubs there. But maybe Gooden was a bit more deserving.
Yeah. I look at the Mets that year, they had three guys that all went over 200 innings. Gooden, Darling, and Walt Terrell, who I got to admit, I don't remember much about.
Yeah.
He had a pretty good, he had a pretty good year that year.
Yeah.
Not really win-loss, but, you know, solid ERA and threw a lot of innings. Levi, looking at that season, the Cubs had Eckersley in the rotation that year, so he was not yet converted to a closer.
He was still a starter.
And you guys had one of the best closers of all time, also Lee Smith, as your closer that year. So like, you guys had two of the best closers in the same pitching, you know, on the team. Same year. So
we had Joe Carter that year as well. I don't know when he got traded.
Oh, didn't he get shipped for Sutcliffe?
Yeah, I was gonna say we started the year with Joe Carter. I knew because his rookie card is Cubs, but I wasn't sure when we. Yeah, was he part of that deal?
He may have been. Yeah.
You're right.
Well, if you want to look that up, in the meantime, Dave Steeb that year had the most WAR out of any starting pitcher in the majors at 7.9, and he received one Cy Young vote. He didn't have. I guess he wasn't showing out for the counting stats because he was 16-8 with a 2.83 ERA and 267 innings pitched. Steeb, 1.13.
I was talking about how impressive, you know, the Tigers have like four guys in the top 20, you know, for MVP voting. Over the National League, the Cubs got six.
Jeez, man.
Sandberg.
That's something.
Sandberg won it. Then you've got Gary Matthews, Sarge, fifth, who had a really good year that year. His on base percentage was .410. He was drawing walks like crazy. He hit .291 too. A really good year for Sarge. Then you had Jody Davis, 10th MVP, 10th place. 12th place, you had Leon Durham, right? And then tied for 17th, you had Bob Dernier?
Bob Dernier, yeah.
Bob Dernier, excuse me, who I have to admit I don't remember. I don't know who that is.
Yeah, and he then, was classic.
Ron Say as well. Yeah.
Wow.
And meanwhile, Gary Carter.
Bob Dernier, I got to look up him.
Gary Carter had 7.5 war and received, and finished 14th in MVP voting. And that 7.5 war was second best among all AL MVP or NL MVP vote receivers recipients.
That was pretty much Bob Dernier's landmark year in baseball. He didn't really do much other than that.
Well, yeah, cool kind of into the season was, you know, besides the Tigers winning the World Series, but coming down to the wire of the season, there was a fun battle between Don Mattingly and Dave Winfield in New York.
Oh yeah,
for the batting title, and it came down to the last game of the season, and Winfield ended the season batting .340, and Mattingly got an extra hit and finished at .343 to win the battle title.
Wow!
So yeah, I thought that was a cool.
I love that. I love batting titles that come down to the last game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that
two guys on the same team, too.
Yeah.
So, yeah, speaking of the Tigers and their World Series win, I learned about Gibson's game-winning home run in the World Series clinching game that he hit against Goose Gossage. And and Gossage was one of the best relievers in the game at the time, obviously, and they were up, the Tigers were up 5-4 and had guys on second and third, and it was suggested that they would walk, intentionally walk Gibson to load the bases, and Gossage is like, no, I want Gibson. And Gibson comes up and just pounds a home run, 3-run home run immediately to put the game out of reach and ultimately for the Tigers to win the World Series. So, yeah, Gibson has two of in terms of championship probability added, two of the biggest home runs in the history of the World Series. So what a badass, Kirk Gibson.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And a quick side note, did you know that in 88, when he hit that home run off of Eckersley in game one of the World Series, that was his only at-bat in the World Series?
Oh, yeah, because he's technically, injured, right?
Oh, yeah, he was limping around the bases, and that's part of the lore of that home run. But, he was so dinged up that was his only at-bat. Gibson, what a badass. And you can still hear him as the color commentator on Tigers broadcasts. So tune in next year.
Absolutely. Right on. It was a fun season to look back on, and some things that I didn't know or had forgotten. 1984, a good year, a fun year, really good. Padres still wearing the good uniforms that year too. I'm looking at their lineup as well, and obviously they went to the World Series.
It was kind of a weird uniform. The letters went up in a V, came down in a V. It was interesting.
I like the brown, yellow, orange vibe.
That motif. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, Tony Gwynn hit .351 that year over, just the terror that he was on throughout the whole decade. You know, guys, one other thing when I was to put a bow on it, when I was researching this episode that I had forgotten or never really looked at that closely. The 80s did not see one back-to-back World Series winner.
Huh. Wow. Yeah.
You know, which I guess, I don't know. I the A's went to two of them, but they only won once.
Yeah.
And I want to say the A's may be even the only team that went to back-to-back World Series.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
88
or done. The Royals made the World Series a couple times, won once. And, you know, the Royals were consistently in the playoffs in the late 70s all the way up to the mid-80s. you know, obviously the 70s were kind of ruled by super teams, you know, mm-hmm. the Reds, the A's,
yeah.
Pirates, yeah. Yankees near the end of the decade. So yeah, whereas the 80s, there was a lot of parody.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Especially, you know, compared to the 90s when it was always like the Braves and, or the Yankees. Yeah, there was a lot of variety there that we didn't really get a taste of, until,
yeah,
in our fandom until more of the 2000s, the aughts and the teens.
Like the numbers don't always back up, you know, the perception that we have. But when we were kids, I felt like, I don't know, like there was just more parody, and like we, like, you know, like I said, the numbers may not speak to this totally. So I'm using my gut and my memory here rather than data, but like, I don't know. There was like, I remember the Mariners being pretty shitty when I was growing up until Griffey arrived. Right. They always kind of sucked. Obviously the White Sox were bad in the late 80s, you know? But still, like, I felt like, you know, there wasn't just like I didn't feel like there was a team that was just god awful every year, you know? Like, right. Whereas now you got some teams that are kind of in the cellar and they don't go anywhere, you know, for seasons on end, it seems like. So,
anyway. Yeah. Yeah. No, I get what you're saying. And yeah, to have like the Orioles 1 year win it, and the Tigers, and then the Royals,
yeah, right.
These teams that like, until 2015, the Royals finally won another one, but otherwise the Orioles still haven't won another one. The Tigers haven't won another one.
Nope.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point.
Yeah. So good stuff. 1984. Congrats to Willie Hernandez, RIP. So let's move over to the music world, guys, because there's certainly a lot to talk about here in 1984. It's really, I guess, one of the things that stood out to me as I was researching this episode, but, you know, MTV had been around for about 3 years now. MTV debuted in 1981, I believe. By the time 1984 hits, like, MTV is like a power player now. You know what I mean? It's like, it's getting to the point where MTV is like as important as the radio, you know, by this time. Like, if you're on a big label and you're putting out a single, it's pretty much mandatory that you've got to make a video. You know what I mean? You have to play that game if you're an artist. And I feel like there were probably a lot of older artists from the 70s that probably like looked uncomfortable making videos. They're probably like, what the hell is this? You know what I mean? Like, but nonetheless, MTV, like 1984, MTV is here. You got the Video Music Awards that are big. MTV had that crossover stuff with wrestling around this time that was huge as well. So I guess when I think of 1984, I think of MTV. You know, it's like when a lot of like famous videos were starting to come out. You know, you had Hot for Teacher, you had Material Girl. You know, you had When Doves Cry, all these really, you know, early entries in the Video Music Hall of Fame, if you will, they all really started to emerge around this time, it seems like. So it seems like to me, this is the year MTV really, really, really breaks through.
Yeah, I think their viewership had just started growing and growing.
More and people getting cable.
Yeah, by 84. Yeah. It was in a lot of homes.
Yep.
And so I think that helped a lot. And I mean, it didn't hurt that like there was a lot of quality music.
Oh, totally.
As well.
Totally.
You know, I mean, there's a lot of legendary records made that year. And you know, I'm gonna just name a few of them, and you guys, when I'm done, just talk about any of them that you think about. But you know, obviously Van Halen 1984 came out that year.
Sure.
Bruce Springsteen, Born in the USA, huge album that year. You mentioned Purple Rain, huge album. Lesser known albums from artists that were later legendary, like it was the first year of Sade's album, Diamond Life, with the hit Smooth Operator on it. Metallica, Ride the Lightning, one of their most legendary albums is...
to me, still the quintessential Metallica record.
Right?
Yeah.
A really, really good record that a lot of people may not know as much about is the Chaka Khan record that year. I feel for you with the Prince song. Took another Prince song on the charts, and that album was huge. And so it also was a good year for like some of the more independent and like college bands. R.E.M. Reckoning was that year. The Lloyd Cole and the Commotions, their album Rattlesnakes, I talked to you guys about a little before. Their album was that year. Talk Talk, It's My Life came out in 1984.
Cocteau Twins.
So many. We don't have enough time to cover them all. One I will talk a little bit about quickly is Don Henley, the gentleman who, you know, people knew him from. He had had one solo album, I think, in 80, 81. But this was the album that made him, like, bigger than the Eagles, basically, almost. You know, his album called Building the Perfect Beast.
Oh, yeah. Which
is basically an album full of songs about either love or politics, which were kind of his theme in the 80s. But, you know, the band on that record is Danny Korchmar, which is a legendary studio guitarist. Played on pretty much every Jackson Brown album, a bunch of James Taylor albums. So it's him, Mike Campbell, Ben Montench, and Stan Lynch.
Dang.
So Heartbreakers. He's got two thirds of the Heartbreakers.
The band surrounded with Don Henley is awesome to begin with. But also, Don Henley got people to, like, he used his star power from the Eagles to invite people to come be on the record, and lots of people said yes. So that album has Lindsey Buckingham on a song, Belinda Carlisle, Randy Newman, Jim Keltner, Waddy Wachtel, Pino Palladino, Steve Porcaro, like legendary musicians in the music scene of L.A., all were on that album. And so it's got most of his 80s hits consistent. Most of the hits off of his solo career of that era consist off that album. Sunset Grill, All She Wants to Do Is Dance, which is a song written by Danny Korchmar. It's just a really good record. And you, the older I get, the more I think I connect in with, like, dad records like that. Because it's kind of a dad record. Yeah. I'll give it that.
Totally.
It's a dad record. But it's a great record. And another one I was going to touch really quick about was that was the year Bryan Adams dropped Reckless, which was a huge album for him in his career. And, you know, featuring the hits Run to You, Heaven, Somebody, Summer of 69. He had Tina Turner on a song on that album called It's Only Love. Mm-hmm. And so that was a huge, huge record as well. There's so many, like I said, titans of records that year. It's hard to just talk about a couple.
Absolutely. No, it's so much, and it really kind of spans genres as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It was one of those times where you could tell it's different than today. It seems like where the music buying public was way more broader into multiple genres.
Yep.
Like people were just like, oh, I only listen to this style.
Right. Right.
And
there's tons of R&B records that are huge that year that came out, you know, absolutely.
Yeah. Like the Billboard Top 100 is just like all over the place. Genre.
It's diverse. Yeah.
What were some of your guys' favorites you discovered?
Well, I was surprised to learn that this album wasn't well received when it came out. Like, its reputation kind of grew as and people warmed up to it more as the years went on, even though it's, from what I gather, a pretty critically acclaimed band. I really like a lot Echo and the Bunnymen's Ocean Rain from that year. Obviously, Killing Moon is the single, but the whole album, just, you know, all the orchestral arrangements on it.
Oh, yeah.
But also You know, this makes sense because I saw Echo and the Bunnymen at Riot Fest a few years ago, and they still sound great, by the way. If you got a chance to go see them, go get them, go out there and get and see the show. They covered Roadhouse Blues when I saw them, and I always thought that Echo and the Bunnymen kind of sounded like a little bit like what the Doors would sound like if the Doors would have made it to the 80s. You know what I mean? like obviously, like he kind of sounds a little bit like sort of a British Jim Morrison, right? And you know, they've got like Love Me Madly or like or Love Her Madly, excuse me. That sounds like a song that like could have fit like in Echo and the Bunnymen's wheelhouse, or like, you know, Touch Me. You know what I mean? Like I could hear them covering those. And then,
yeah, for sure. Yeah. I agree with that. When I first put that album on and I hear Silver,
yeah,
I get immediately Moody Blues vibes. Like, right, they have too. A retro vibe for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's such a good album. It's crazy to think that it wasn't well received when it was first released.
Yeah, I know. It grew in nature. And again, like I said, they're a pretty critically acclaimed band there in the early 80s. But that one's really grown on me. It's not like an album I really listened. I didn't really listen to the band much up until maybe in the last 10 or 15 years. I just, you know, wasn't cool enough. But I've really warmed up to them, and that album's become one of my favorites of this year. So that's a really standout record to me. A couple others. I think they're just, I'll just mention these just for, I think, kind of their quirkiness, each of them. I really like Stay Hungry by Twisted Sister, which came out in 1984.
That's a great album.
Yeah, it is. And it showed that like metal like can be kind of fun too. You know what I mean? Right. It doesn't have to be entirely like macabre, you know? I mean, granted, they have a song called Burn in Hell on it, but even that kind of seems tongue in cheek. It's just, yeah, they were in Pee-wee's Big Adventure, right? They had a sense of humor about themselves, you know what I mean? That it seemed like they didn't take themselves too seriously, which I appreciate, yeah.
No, so. I agree. That album, you know, they put out a lot of albums, but that album especially has got to be in the top of their catalog, but... It's just a shame that I think over time they haven't gotten the respect that I think they're due as a band.
I would agree with that.
I think a lot of people are. It's hard to look past like the weird hair and the makeup and the spandex like they were. Yeah. But yeah. like the quality of the music and the band and the lyrics weren't awful by any means.
I think JJ French is a good guitarist too.
Right. Yeah. So yeah. It's a shame that they don't get more respect.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Like, and so what? Like, some things should be fun. You know what I mean? Like, I kind of like the fact that they didn't take themselves too seriously. But like you said, Levi, the music still holds up. They knew how to capitalize on MTV. Like a lot of metal bands maybe didn't as much at that time quite yet. You know, like right. They have those funny videos for "I Want to Rock" and "We're Not Gonna Take It" with that.
Right.
It's got the antagonist in the video is that same dickhead, you know, that's like,
from Animal
what do you
House?
Want to do with your life, you know?
Isn't he from like Animal House? Yeah.
Yes. It's the guy from Animal House. It's the guy on the horse in Animal House. Yeah. I forgot the actor's name, but he's great. And they just, those videos are phenomenal. So that one really stands out to me as a really fun record from that year. And another album that I think swung and missed, and I think it just kind of makes a little bit of a bigger point that you can't always force things. Deep Purple's Perfect Strangers. Are you guys familiar with this record?
Yeah, I've heard it a bunch.
Yeah. I don't hate it, but it was a reunion album, right? Of the 70s, the Mach 2 lineup of Deep Purple.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is considered by most of the fans as their favorite era.
I think so. Yeah. It's the Machine Head lineup.
Right. Yeah.
You know? So it's
one of those albums where I just think it was never gonna be able to meet the expectations of a reunion album.
And it was
also a creature of its time. So totally. Like some of the songwriting is kind of like throwaway feel like. Yep.
I hear it, guys, and what I hear is like a 70s band trying really hard to fit into the 80s. You know what I mean? Like a band that like didn't know necessarily how to transition. And obviously it's a reunion record, so it, you know, they probably have to force some chemistry there, and it's pretty well documented how acrimonious it was between Blackmore and those guys. So it was, I would imagine, just because Deep Purple, and we've talked about this on other episodes of the podcast when we've talked about the 70s, Deep Purple was so huge in the 70s that, like, I don't think a lot of people today realize how big they were. They were like as big as Led Zeppelin, you know, like, well, I mean, it was, they were
outside
huge.
Outside of the USA.
Yeah, especially like,
they were
outside
huge
of the
US. In the USA, but like outside of the USA, they were as big as Zeppelin.
Absolutely. And so, you know, maybe some of that residual stuff from the 70s was kind of hanging over them. I know that Ian Gillan, he did that one record with Black Sabbath that wasn't well received, and Blackmore kind of did his own thing. So, you know, it's there were some older acts from the 70s. I say older, relative term at that time. That really transitioned to the 80s well, or at least, you know, they made it work. I think of bands like Genesis, ZZ Top, Rush, yes. Tom Petty, Kenny Loggins, yes, right? After they cleaned up Aerosmith. Deep Purple, and I'd say to some degree too as well, Jimmy Page, didn't really do that. Like they couldn't fit the 80s. You know what I mean? Right. I don't know if it just they didn't like the sound or it wasn't in them, but it just... Yeah, to me, I bring up that album Perfect Strangers because it's indicative of that sort of failure to adapt.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, it's crazy to think that there was a band that had Paul Rodgers and Jimmy Page in it during that era, and they weren't like the biggest thing on the planet.
Totally. Totally. And there really are parts of that album I like. There are parts of that Fur record.
But like, you would think like that would have been way bigger than it was, and it just... You know, flat songwriting and getting caught up in the machine. They did a second record, the Firm did, and it's not as good as the first. And the first wasn't the best album ever made to begin with. So, yeah.
No. Yeah. So, yeah, Purple fits in that, and Perfect Strangers seems to be a good example of it. And I assume, like, I think they toured that year, and I assume it did pretty well. It was a highly anticipated tour. Because they were so huge the decade before, but yeah, it's unfortunate.
I'll have to do some research. Hopefully, it wasn't one of those tours where they all the old fans show up to hear like Highway Star, and they make them sit through like the entire Perfect Strangers album first. Right. They're like, no, first you're listening to every new song.
Yeah, you know, one. I'll mention one more, and Jonathan, I'll pass the baton. But the other album I had kind of forgotten about that came out this year. Was the Woman in Red soundtrack, which is almost entirely Stevie Wonder songs.
That
soundtrack's
that's a banger, dude. Yeah.
Oh, dude, it is. And I had forgotten about it, you know, because it's a soundtrack. So maybe just, and it's like that movie was big in the 80s, but it's not like a movie that's like stood the test of time, really. You know what I mean? It's like, it, you know, Gene Wilder, Kelly LeBrock. It's a very 80s film. With a very 80s soundtrack, but I love Stevie. I mean, like, obviously, I just called to say I Love You was one of the biggest hits of the year. And he's got that one song on there called, Don't Drive Drunk or Don't Drink and Drive. Right, Don't Drive Drunk.
Yeah.
It's great. And I love that Stevie was never afraid to stretch out a single. You know, like I just called to say I love you, like, approaches 7 minutes, you know, like, I'm sure, like, the producers were like, Stevie, he's like, no, I'm not done yet, you know, like, just, I liked the fact, the dude let the tape keep rolling, which I like. Oh, yeah. Anyway, yeah, so those are my four.
Songs that are like that.
Oh, yeah.
All of a sudden, you know, one, for example, is I Believe When I Fall in Love.
Yes.
Like, all of a sudden, at the end of that song, it's like that sweet love song ends, and then it turns into, like, a funk jam.
Yes. I love just kept
the tape going. Yeah.
Yeah, you didn't know what he was going to do, and that was cool, and he's the coolest. I know we're talking about 1984 here, but I kicked myself in the butt. He played in Chicago, like, 2 weeks ago, and some friends went, and they said it was phenomenal. So I really regret not going because I'm probably running out of chances to see that guy. So
yeah, Yeah. He's definitely on my list of one I'd like to catch too.
Yep. Yeah. I don't feel like the tour was that well promoted. You know what I mean? Like I was like, whoa, that's a big deal. He's touring, you know, he did like an anniversary tour, of Songs in the Key of Life, like maybe 10 years ago or something. But like, I don't feel like he consistently tours. So anyway,
in one of my YouTube saved clips, I have the performance with him and Pharrell doing Get Lucky
at
one of the awards ceremonies or something. Uh-huh. And like, it's like they're in like a recording studio and like you see like black glass and the lights that says recording and all that. And like in the middle of it, the black glass slides down and Daft Punk's there and they're like,
whoa.
Awesome.
Yeah.
It sounds like a dream.
Yeah, take that whole thing on the road. I'll see you.
Yeah. Yeah. Pharrell, Stevie Wonder, Daft Punk. Let's get it going.
Bring it on.
Nice.
Yeah, let it rip, Jonathan. Those are kind of the four ones I wanted to touch on.
Yeah. You guys touched on a lot that I was also listening to over the last couple of weeks. You're right. Like, there's a big range between, you know, some of the lesser known stuff and the really big stuff. With the lesser known stuff, and albums like from the band Felt. And speaking of a band that very much sounds like what the Doors would have sounded like in the 80s, I think. And Cabaret Voltaire. I'm always looking for a good excuse to listen to Cabaret Voltaire because I love being reminded about how industrial music existed before Nine Inch Nails. And I say that as a big Nine Inch Nails fan. And I love learning, like, when you hear a band for the first time and you're like, oh, this is where one of my favorite bands was inspired. Like, And just like stumbling upon that and realizing that there was life before your favorite band. So between that and like the Cocteau Twins, I have no idea what the Cocteau Twins are singing about, but I really dig it. I don't know what the words are that they're saying, even though I think it's English. But that's fine. It's all about, for me, it's all about the vibes with Cocteau Twins and, you know, just like this dream pop. Just soaking in all the dream pop. And I'm not breaking any news here, but the Replacements' Let It Be album finally like really clicked with me on this go around. And Gabe, I know you've sung its praises many times on the podcast. But sure. I mean, the range of that band what they were doing, you know, transitioning from the punk into these lo-fi recordings that are, you know, made them kind of indie darlings. I very much appreciated that. So you have that. And then like the mid popularity in
before
terms of
like, before you mm-hmm. go too far from the Pretenders, mm-hmm. we have to just say, like, it was amazing that Learning to Crawl even came out because,
yes.
Guys,
yeah. And I was just about to segue to them.
Sorry.
Okay. No, that's fine. I it's one of those albums that, you know, it's out there and I just don't spin it that often. And then, I'm always game for Back on the Chain Gang. Like I'll never turn that off.
Oh no, it's a great album.
Yeah.
It's so, you know, that would be a list that would be fun to put together maybe as a side project someday between us. Is to put together a list of albums from their year's perspective, like one or two albums from each year that we think still hold up. And I would say from 1984, this album may be one of the ones that holds up the most.
Yeah, The Pretenders Learning to Crawl. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. It sounds great. Between that and the Echo and the Bunnymen album, both of those albums sound amazing. Like they were recorded.
Yep.
Last year.
That's the first time I got introduced to Echo and the Bunnymen was probably 7 or 8 years ago. I found that on vinyl at a yard sale.
Nice. Nice.
Yeah.
And it's hard to believe that the Pretenders were able to create that album just in the wake of losing two of their members who passed away. So it's a remarkable testament to the power of creativity and getting back on your feet, or as it is, learning to crawl.
Well, yeah, and I mean, not I, you know, not to sugarcoat it, but it wasn't, you know, they got into a car wreck or something. It was like two pretty gnarly overdoses.
Yeah.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, it, yeah, like a lot of lesser people wouldn't have been able to rise from that.
Yeah.
You know, it takes a special set of people to come through to the other end of that. And absolutely. So to be able to do that and create that art and then have that art stand for decades and still like mean something that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And it's awesome that they finally got in. I don't remember what year it was in the hall, but it was later than it should have been.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. Do you guys know Chrissy Hynde and Ray Davies had a kid?
Did not know that.
Now that you've seen it, I may have seen that.
I think she moved back to Ohio too, which is a kind of a cool punk move, you know, like as you get older, like move back to Ohio. Why not?
From England, right? Like, because she otherwise mostly lives in England, even though she's American.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and that's what My City Was Gone was all about.
Yeah.
The song My City Was Gone was written about Akron, Ohio.
Yeah. Her and LeBron.
That's right.
Her and LeBron are tight.
Can we get the her and LeBron collab sometime?
Well, I mean, we got Martha soon. And Snoop, right?
Yeah.
So
why not?
Progression from that is LeBron and Chrissy Hynde.
So
LeBron
so,
still seems to have a lot of affection for Ohio, so I think he'd do it.
Yeah, absolutely. But then to finish it off with albums that I was focusing on in terms of, you know, more of the higher profile stuff is Born in the USA. And, you know, admittedly, as far as Springsteen goes, I'm a big Springsteen fan. But I pass over Born in the USA often when I'm going to pick out some Springsteen to listen to because of the overplayed singles between, you know, the Born in the USA and Dancing in the Dark and and you know, the kind of the cheesy cover too. It's a cheesy cover, that album cover. It overshadows like the true value of the rest of the album, in my opinion. And I think it would, like, this album would reach a whole other audience if it like didn't have that title and cover. Because songs like No Surrender and Bobby Jean and My Hometown and let's face it, you know, the infamous Glory Days line, no pitcher throws a speedball, Bruce.
Right.
That is not a term that we use, that pitchers
use. It was like a Jersey Shore thing. It was a very regional thing.
Very regional. But all that being said, even with the hits, I'm very grateful for the song Dancing in the Dark because it's like this unapologetic synth pop, Dancing in the Dark is. And I think it's one of the larger singular influences on one of my favorite contemporary bands, The War on Drugs. It's because in my opinion, The War on Drugs says, let's see how close we can fly to the sun that is Dancing in the Dark, but without burning up.
Yeah.
And I feel like with a lot of The War on Drugs, the real album bangers, that is their primary, that is their North Star. I'm simplifying
this. Brothers in Arms.
Yeah, what's sure. That? Yeah, I'm simplifying things here. I feel like that there are a lot of indie bands now who appreciate Springsteen, but they say, whoa. I don't know about like the Born in the USA era. Like, they're afraid of it. But the War on Drugs embraces it.
No, yeah. In my opinion, my two favorite songs probably on it are I'm on Fire and Dancing in the Dark.
Sure.
I think, you know, 1984 was a really good year for the synthesizer.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and so that song specifically, the usage of that, you know, it's very tasteful in that song,
mm-hmm.
the keyboard mm-hmm. usage.
Yeah.
And it just like perfectly accentuates it. And, I've always just liked I'm on Fire as one of his best songs. I I don't know. For some reason, it's one of those songs of his that just connected with me ever since I was a little kid.
Because well.
Yeah, my sister had that album. Yeah. So yeah, I was introduced. Mm-hmm. All this music is music that I was introduced to like fresh through my sister, like direct link. So yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, good stuff.
Well, it was the nation's first introduction to Courtney Cox, right?
Yes. It was.
Right?
The Dancing in the Dark video.
Yes, with that adorable short haircut too. Right.
Well, that was the era of the what was the movie? The Legend of Billie Jean.
Right. Wasn't it? Something right. like everybody that. Everybody was going for the Pat Benatar look, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Nice, yeah, including nice three girls at Richmond High. Okay, that's what the movie stated.
Yep. I'm
looking at the Hot 100 here, guys, from '84. So the Hot 100 Billboard year-end singles, Hot 100 singles, and like 2 points. The first is like 80 of these songs are anthems. You know what I mean? That like right. everybody knows. Like 80, there's probably not many years where like at least 80 out of 100 of the hottest singles of the year are like songs that like everybody knows, right?
I couldn't tell you three of them this year.
Right. Yeah, there's that. But I mean, even during maybe later parts of the 80s or, you know, yeah, just anyway, there's just this. If you look at the Hot 100, I'm not going to read them all, but it's When Doves Cry is number one. But it's a list of anthems, you know, and like, you know. Like I said, there's only like 5 or 6 tunes on here that like I'm not like that I don't know right off the top of my head, you know. And also, the other point about this Hot 100 list, they really, you know, just obviously the industry was much different then. The albums really had a longer shelf life. You know what I mean? Like you the albums. Had legs because you staggered the release of the singles, of course. So a lot of these singles, including like Owner of a Lonely Heart and not Van Halen's Jump, but the Pointer Sisters' Jump, For My Love, you know, those and Lionel Richie All Night Long, those songs, those albums all came out the year before, right? You know, they came out in like later 83, but you know, they were still charting in 84. Yep. And you don't see that anymore. You know, I mean, albums don't have legs like they used to. Whereas a lot of Huey Lewis is on here, you know, Sports came out in 83. So, you know, there's, I haven't broken down the totals here, but I would imagine that, you know, at least a quarter of these tunes or more came yeah. out, you know, on LPs released the year before.
They're not on the King Gizzard plan of a new album every 2 weeks.
No, definitely not. No, you really, you know, you could, if you had more than 2 hit singles, you could really milk a lot out of an album.
Oh,
back
yeah.
Then,
no,
know?
It was a juggernaut. Yeah. Man. The whole yeah. industry was a juggernaut. There yep. was money in all, there was enough money in all the genres to push each of them.
Absolutely.
And so that's why the lists are so diverse and all over.
Mm-hmm. It was a glorious time, guys. So we'll put a bow on it there. I appreciate everybody listening. Want to tell everybody to go to rockchew.com where you can find all of our episodes. You can also, we're on YouTube. We've got some fun playlists on the website as well. You can find us on Instagram at rockchew. Check us out on Facebook as well. It's good to be back. We'll be giving you some more content soon. So it's Rock in Chew. On Instagram. So that's in as in Huey Lewis and the News. So thanks again. And it was really good hanging with you guys again. And it was a fun taking a trip to 1984. Have a good one, everybody.
Peace. Bye-bye.